You know, you talk to these people that, this is off topic, as you can see what's up on the screen right now, but you talk to these people that say, oh, no, the Constitution doesn't apply in my local government. It's interesting to me that when we still had a sound understanding, at least a number of people had a sound understanding, there were people that put together city charters. And the city charter for Nauvoo was put together by basically Joseph Smith and the 12. It's interesting that the, and maybe someday we do a presentation about this, but their city charter mentions the United States Constitution 7 times. It's fascinating to me that they wanted to make sure they kept their actions within the bounds that were established and what they took an oath to do. So it's a fascinating perspective when today we feel like we operate outside those bounds. Of course, Article 6 of the United States Constitution requires everyone that holds office to take an oath to uphold the United States Constitution. So there's got to be a tie-in that somehow they're able to be, you know, connected with at some point. We said we were going to talk about an LDS perspective on war. It's interesting, I've had a number of people since last time we met. We talked about an LDS perspective on liberty, and they talked to me and they said, you know, we thought it was going to be your opinion. And I said, well, it is my opinion. It just happens to be the same opinion that the prophets and the scriptures hold, you know, and I don't want to be counter to that. And so, you know, when I show these things, it probably means a lot more to you if you have some of these people's, you know, names and faces behind it instead of just my opinion. And so I hope that tonight what we do again will be similar, where there will be adequate information, there'll be adequate evidence that I didn't have to make this stuff up. And I've got 191 slides to show you. I'll just tell you up front. And so somebody said, can we be here all night? No, I hope we're going to be able to run these pretty quickly. I shouldn't tell you the number. Somebody will be up there counting. But there's a message to be had instead of just worrying about the count. I had to throw an awful lot of information out. Unbelievable amounts of information. There should be enough here for you to get the message. But there's a lot more where this comes from. Now, how many of you here remember the MX missile project? Okay, there's some in the audience. This was a grandiose plan that the United States military proposed to pour money all over Utah in. Okay, now basically what this was they were going to set up a rail system that was a shell game in the western desert where they were going to put bunkers out there and they were going to move rail cars supposedly with intercontinental ballistic missiles on them. Okay, some were dummies and some were real. We could explain to you why this is important if you really wanted to know, but we don't have time tonight. But the idea was that they were going to, you know, basically confuse the Soviets so they wouldn't know where to send their nukes. And it was going to pour billions upon billions upon billions upon billions of dollars into the Utah economy. And everybody was just ecstatic about it. And after all, we're all patriots, aren't we? We want to do the right thing, don't we? You know, we're going to make this country strong and everything else like that. We had a very little, quiet, soft-spoken prophet. When I met, we don't want to get distracted too much by that, but when I met with President Kimball, he had one of these little voices that you had to listen very carefully to like this, and you hung on every word. He wasn't a boisterous, loud, over-the-top kind of guy. And you know, when he talked, you listened. And it's a funny thing about this MX thing. It seemed like it was 99% of the state. I was probably in the 1%, but the 99% of the state were just enthusiastic about this. It was going to be a boon to the economy. And this little quiet prophet got up and quietly diffused the whole thing. And you know what's really, really makes me feel good? All the enthusiasm in the state went away. I'm thinking, yes. I wish they'd speak more today about things like this. And in a minute, you're going to see a couple of things they were very over-the-top direct on. And this first thing I'm going to talk about is a presentation that Spencer W. Kimball gave, June Enzyme, 1976. And so, and you'll see the references here in a minute. I'm going to take some quotes out of it. It's called The False Gods We Worship. That was an instrumental presentation in actually diffusing this over-the-top militaristic perspective that was being expressed in Utah at that time. Now, we've strayed far from that in the past 35-some years. Okay, we really have. But it was so pointed. And so I've got that, and then I've got another thing that's something that the first presidency did in December of 1945, December 14th, 1945, my father-in-law's 18th birthday. They came out, and they actually took a position, and they actually encouraged letters to be written in to the United States House and Senate in regards to these things. Okay, so if we just went through those two things, and that was all tonight, and you left, I'm not going to suggest you do that, but there's more to it if you don't want to leave. But the fact of the matter is, it should show that this gospel of Jesus Christ is not based upon militarism. And honestly, there's an exactly opposite perspective. So having said all of that, let's run through these quickly. There's President Kimball with his June 76 Enzyme message of the first presidency. Go home and read it. It's required reading in my family. And I bring it up as often as I can in church. Talk about hands making a stir about things sometimes. Well, yeah, that's how we feel. I'm just going to quote directly from this. I don't have to make this up. He charges the saints with a grievous crime, an eternal crime. So let's just go through what he says. In spite of our delight in defining ourselves as modern and our tendency to think we possess a sophistication that no people in the past ever had, in spite of these things, we are on the whole an idolatrous people, a condition most repugnant to the Lord. Now when the prophet says, you're repugnant to the Lord, we ought to say, wait, how do I correct this going on? We are a warlike people, easily distracted from our assignment of preparing for the coming of the Lord. When enemies rise up, we commit vast resources to the fabrication of gods of stone and steel, ships, planes, missiles, fortifications, and depend on them for protection and deliverance. When threatened, we become anti-enemy instead of pro-kingdom of God. We train a man in the art of war and we call him a patriot, thus in the manner of Satan's counterfeit of true patriotism, perverting the Savior's teaching. Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. Of course, he's quoting the Savior's teaching while he was in mortality. We forget that if we are righteous, the Lord will either not suffer our enemies to come upon us, and this is the special promise to the inhabitants of the land of the Americas, or he will fight our battles for us. This he is able to do. For as he said in the time of his betrayal, thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels? We can imagine what fearsome soldiers they would be. King Jehoshaphat and his people were delivered by such a troop. And when Elijah's life was threatened, he comforted his servant by saying, fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them. The Lord then opened the eyes of the servant, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elijah. Enoch, too, was a man of great faith who would not be distracted from his duties by the enemy. And so great was the faith of Enoch that he led the people of God, and their enemies came to battle against them. And he spake the word of the Lord, and the earth trembled, and the mountains fled, even according to his command, and the rivers of water were turned out of their course, and the roar of the lions was heard out of the wilderness. All nations feared greatly, so powerful was the word of Enoch. What are we to fear when the Lord is with us? Can we not take the Lord at his word and exercise a particle of faith in him? Our assignment is affirmative, to forsake the things of the world as ends in themselves, to leave off idolatry and press forward in faith, to carry the gospel to our enemies that they might no longer be our enemies. We must leave off the worship of modern-day idols and a reliance on the arm of flesh, for the Lord has said to all the world in our day, I will not spare any that remain in Babylon. Wow. I mean, it was a very huge indictment. And the saints heard it. It was wonderful. I just wanted to cheer. Okay, this next little presentation is just, there's about 20 slides in this one. The first presidency of the LDS Church in December of 1945 came out against the universal draft. Now, almost everybody that thinks anything about this in the church thinks that it would be wonderful because whatever. They fill in their own blank. But the church came out, and this was signed by the first presidency. You see pictures there. And there's a showing of where you can get some of these things because there's numerous places that you can reference them in. And so if you can go back and look at any of those sources, you'll be able to find this in its original. Messages of the First Presidency, Volume 6 might be one that's in your home. And you can go back and find it in the Improvement Era, too. So the old Improvement Era, 1945 and 46. At any rate, they took a stand against the draft. Interesting, isn't it? Well, here's what they said. There are 17 concerns. I don't have to make these up, folks. And they're very cogent, and they're well thought out. Of course, there was guys like J. Reuben Clark that wrote them. So, number one, by taking our sons at the most impressionable age of their adolescence and putting them into army camps under rigorous military discipline, we shall seriously endanger their initiative. Why? Because you're in a socialist collectivist setting, guys. We used to call it, when I was in, three hots and a cot. Three hot meals and a place to sleep. They told you where to be and what to do, what to wear, everything, you know, going on. I don't need to make it, I shouldn't have to, you know, maybe editorialize on these. We shall seriously endanger their initiative, thereby impairing one of the essential elements of American citizenship. While in its face, the suggested plan might not seem to visualize the army camp training, yet there seems little doubt that our military leaders contemplate such a period with similar recurring periods after the boys are placed in the reserves. Two, by taking our boys from their homes, we shall deprive them of parental guidance and control of this important period of their youth, and there is no substitute for the care and love of a mother for a young son. Now, just a minute. How many LDS families today say, my kid reaches 18, I boot him out? It's like this rite of passage. And here the first president is saying, you know what? It's still good to be able to exercise some opportunity to teach these young people. It's astounding to me. I mean, it's almost like it's become part of our religion that we separate our children from ourselves. We send them off to college or something. I don't know what it is. But anyway, their position was, it's great to have these kids in our homes. Three, we shall take them out of school and suffer their minds to be directed in other channels so that very many of them, after leaving the Army, will never return to finish their schooling, thus over a few years materially reducing the literacy of our whole nation. Four, we shall give opportunity to teach our sons not only the way to kill, but also, in too many cases, the desire to kill, thereby increasing lawlessness and disorder to the consequent upset into the stability of our national society. God said at Sinai, thou shalt not kill. Have you ever heard if that was rescinded? That sixth commandment? Number five, we shall take them from the refining, ennobling, character-building atmosphere of the home and place them under a drastic discipline in an environment that is hostile to most of the finer and nobler things of home and life. Boy, so many ways that I could get distracted on these things. But back when I served, there was only one missionary allowed per year per ward. Do you remember those days? Because Vietnam was going on and people were saying, why should our boys get drafted and go get killed? A few Mormons are all going to be draft dodgers and go on missions. So the church said, we're only going to send one missionary per year per ward. But if you'd served, there was no constraint. So they scraped the bottom of the barrel and they sent me. I mean, I was discharged the 5th of January. I was in the mission home the 8th of January. I had to go to ZCMI. The 8th of January was a Saturday. I had to go to ZCMI on Monday to get my suits and ties and shirts. The suits never did fit, by the way. But the fact was, on Wednesday, I was in the mission field. It was one of those, we're on our way, baby. But the reason I only mention that right now is to not tell a history story myself, but to say the contrast between what I had been involved in the military was like different universes when I got immersed in the mission. It was a total, complete, universal change from everything. And I had been separated from the nobler and finer things of home and of life. And it was a total contrast to me. Anyway, 5, 6. We shall make our sons the victims of systemized allurements to gamble, to drink, to smoke, to swear, associate with lewd women, to be selfish, idle, irresponsible, save under restraint of force, to be common, coarse, and vulgar, all contrary to and destructive of the American home. Young man I know quite well, not too long ago, got back from Afghanistan. And he said about the young men that he served with that they forgot everything their mother ever told them. And it's tragic that that happens. 7, we shall deprive our sons of any adequate religious training and activity during their training years, for the religious element of Army life is both inadequate and ineffective. I agree. That's what I experienced. 8, we shall put them where they may be indoctrinated with a wholly un-American view of the aims and purposes of their individual lives and of the life of the whole people and nation, which are founded on the ways of peace, whereas they will be taught to believe in the ways of war. 9, we shall take them away from all participation in the means and measures of production to the economic loss of the whole nation. 10, we shall lay them open to wholly erroneous ideas of their duties to themselves and to their families and to society in the matter of independence, self-sufficiency, individual initiative, and what we have come to call American manhood. Again, 3 hots and a cot. I knew guys when I was in, if they had 3 hots and a cot, they didn't care about anything else. I mean, it was, we could tell you lots of stories. 11, we shall subject them to encouragement and a belief that they can always live off the labors of others, through the government or otherwise. 12, we shall make possible their building into a military caste, which from all human experience bodes ill for that equality and unity which must always characterize the citizenry of a republic. So you get points, you can get federal jobs, for example, if you serve. And there's a lot of good people that can't get jobs, and they compete against somebody that got 5 points for this or 5 points for that in the point system they end up having. Well, and there's special treatment, if you will. 13, by creating an immense standing army, we shall create in our liberty to our liberties and free institutions a threat foreseen and condemned by the founders of the Republic and by the people of this country from that time till now. Great standing armies have always been the tools of ambitious dictators to the destruction of freedom. And we're going to read here in a while some statements by the Founding Fathers to that effect. They were very concerned about large military forces and this standing army stuff. In fact, they prohibited it in the Constitution. 14, by the creation of a great war machine, we shall invite and tempt the waging of war against foreign countries upon little or no provocation. For the possession of great military power always breeds thirst for domination, for empire, and for a rule by might, not right. An old saying, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Isn't it? Well, if we got a big military, hey, why not use it? Okay. By building a huge armed establishment, we shall belie our protestations of peace and peaceful intent and force other nations to be to a like course of militarism, so placing upon the peoples of the earth crushing burdens of taxation that with their present tax load will hardly be bearable, and that will gravely threaten our social, economic, and governmental systems. Are we there today? Absolutely, unquestionably. And the fact of the matter is, you're going to see, there's a quotation I have a little bit later in here that will remind me to tell you this little story about when I went to see John Kennedy in 8 weeks before he was assassinated. He came to Salt Lake, and he spoke in the tabernacle. And in his speech in the tabernacle, he absolutely took an opposite perspective to everything we'll be presenting tonight. He was a wonderful shill on behalf of globalistic militarism of the United States. And he said science and technology required it, basically. But war always causes debt. We'll talk about that a little bit here, too. But the fact of the matter is, we have choking debt now because of our militarism. 16, we shall make the whole earth one great military camp whose separate armies, headed by war-minded officers, will never rest until they are at one another's throats in what will be the most terrible contest the world has ever seen. Wow. All the advantages for the protection of the country offered by a standing army may be obtained by the National Guard system, which has proved so effective in the past and which is unattended by the evils of entire mobilization. Okay, so then they go into the, you know, the Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. And you talk about the divine message that heralded the birth of the Savior, and peace on earth, goodwill toward men, the Constitution of the United States. They're calling upon some pretty heavy-duty support, I think. It says, knowing that our Constitution and government was set up under it and were inspired of God and should be preserved to the blessing not only of your own citizenry, but as an example to the blessing of all the other world, as an example. So we don't convert people by the sword. There's been some religions that have done that or tried to do it. See, we stand as an example. To the blessing of all the world, we have the honor and respectfully to urge you to do your utmost to defeat any plan designed to bring about the compulsory military service of our citizenry. Should it be argued that our complete armament is necessary for our safety, it may be confidently replied that a proper foreign policy implemented by an effective diplomacy can avert the dangers that are feared. By the way, President Benson absolutely said we were safe as a nation if our foreign policy were proper. I think we can see that that safety net has been taken away because our foreign policy has been off on a tangent for many, many years now. What this country needs and what the world needs is a will for peace, not war. God will help our efforts to bring this about. Signed, First Presidency. Interesting, isn't it? So different than the perspective that so many today hold. It's astounding to me how far we've changed, and it's only a generation. So war. It's the greatest of all obscenities. It truly is. It magnifies and facilitates all other evils. It mocks the Prince of Peace. It denies the angelic proclamation, peace on earth, goodwill toward man. It violates the Sixth Commandment completely and unequivocally. It's legalized and institutionalized mass murder. It unleashes the destructive fury of the most powerful mortal force on earth, and that force is government. Government is force, legalized, and it's really hard to stand against it when government gets mobilized in a thing like this. War is the most onerous burden that any nation undertakes, and what we're going to see that the Founding Fathers were so concerned about this that they put the process into the most deliberative process that they could find. They put it as close to the people while still maintaining the republic, a representative form of government, because they knew that the people's lives, fortunes, and sacred honor would be called into question whenever there was war. And they knew that it was mass murder institutionalized and legalized. And so it really is supposed to be entered into without a lot of just willy-nilliness that seems to be our way today. Shock and awe, baby. Let's just do it. We can stand offshore a little ways and push some buttons and kill thousands of people. Okay, so Satan and his minions instigate war because it destroys the bodies granted their children, his children. He laughs. He's ecstatic about it. It destroys agency. It magnifies all evil. If you can think of an evil that isn't magnified by it, we probably ought to talk, because I'll bet I can tie it in some way. It facilitates immorality, infidelity, faithlessness, violence, theft, hatred, and it could go on and on. And it always brings debt. Always, always, always. And George Washington talked about that in his farewell address. He counseled us to avoid it, because we would be in debt. And we have been in perpetual war since we got the United Nations, basically. And NATO and CETO and CENTO and ANZUS, all of these entangling alliances that we're going to find out where the Founding Fathers thought about them. And I keep talking about the Founding Fathers. Well, why? They aren't prophets, are they? Well, we're going to see how the Lord felt about them in just a minute. Okay. Can we avoid war all the time? No. Evil people bring it about. It's just the way it is. I mean, Satan is going to rule and reign. You've maybe heard about this with this horrible thing about blood and you take the treasures of the world and all those kind of things. You've heard about this, okay? Okay, so evil people do this. because they're under the goadings of their master. So war is brought about. It is. It does. It happens. So good people oftentimes are compelled to engage in it as much as they'd like to avoid it, as much as us would like to be home with our wives and our children and, you know, raising our sheep or whatever the heck you're doing with your life, you know, living our careers. Good people often get distracted by it. They have to. So God has instructed us on how we can continue to live his plan of life and exaltation and not be trapped by the way Satan would have us get, you know, marching off to the beat of the war drum every time we turn around. Some of you may or may not know that here in September a year ago, the United States Senate, I mentioned this last time, passed Senate Joint Resolution 41. 83 senators co-sponsored it, including both of ours. 90 senators voted in favor of it, 9 did not vote, and 1 voted against it. Rand Paul. Yeah, Rand. He voted against it. But the fact of the matter is, 90 senators said that we should have preemptive war against Iran. It's time to start another war, folks. We're winding them down, so let's get going again. There's a lot of our senators that have never seen a war they didn't want our country in. And a lot of us think that to be a patriot, we have to support those things. Go back and look at President Kimball's talk again. You know, it's a false impression. And we've been distracted. So, you've seen this little slide before. There's this little segment right here, number 3, which is really only about 4.62% of the whole timeline, is over 40% of the book, right? We looked at this last time. So we have this whole spectrum of stuff, but the top themes, the Savior, of course, warfare, missionary work, and secret combinations based upon verse count. As you can see, warfare is number 2. So the Book of Mormon gives us some critically important counsel and advice about war, if we're willing to read it with that in mind. A lot of us completely, I told you how some people talk about the Book of Ether back here, which is really a huge portion in terms of its years, and only 31 pages long. It's the essence of 1,600 years is boiled into 31 pages because the Lord knew we needed it. Moroni, when he was able to bridge that down to 31 pages, he knew us. He'd seen us. He knew us. So he wrote in there exactly what we needed. We talked about that. I'll mention it again in a little bit when we have the words of the prophets in front of us. But a lot of us say, well, it's another testament of Christ. It is. Absolutely it is. And we would hope and pray that we'd all understand that. But these other subjects, oftentimes, we completely ignore them. Missionary work, we spend a little bit of time on. Warfare, none at all. And secret combinations, you better not go there. Just don't even talk to me about that. We're going to talk about that in an upcoming lecture. But war. Second most popular subject in the Book of Mormon. I don't know what I'm saying. I shouldn't say popular, but it's second most exposed or common, whatever. Okay. Here's what President Benson said about this. The second great reason why we must make the Book of Mormon a center of focus of studies is that it was written for our day. The Nephites never had the book. Neither did the Lamanites of ancient times. It was meant for us. Mormon wrote near the end of the Nephite civilization. Under the inspiration of God, who sees all things in the beginning, he abridges centuries of records, choosing the stories, speeches, and events that would be most helpful to us. If the ancient Nephite prophets saw our day and chose those things which would be of greatest worth to us, is not that how we should study the Book of Mormon? By the way, he gave this talk in 1986. I had started studying the Book of Mormon about 1976 in this manner. Since then, I've tried to get through the Book of Mormon 6 times a year. Okay? You'd think I'd have it memorized by now, wouldn't you? That shows how slow a learner I am. But the fact of the matter is, back in about 1976, when I started reading the Book of Mormon as today's news today, it started to open up to me and unfold in a manner that I could not possibly imagine previous to that. It's like reading today's news today. I mean, you can read it in the headlines and the side stories of your newspapers all the time, and it is just astounding how we knew that. Anyway, should we not ask ourselves, why did the Lord inspire Mormon or Moroni or Alma to include that in his record. What lesson can I learn from that to help me live this day and age? And there's example after example of how the question will be answered. For example, in the Book of Mormon, we find a pattern for preparing for the second coming. See, remember that segment up there that was the shortest segment that had the most written about it? Remember we talked last time? That was a period of time in the Nephite era when they had a constitutional republic and they're preparing for the coming of the Savior. Wow. I mean, isn't that exactly what we've been given here? Amazing. A major portion of the book centers on the few decades just prior to Christ coming to America. By careful study of that time period, we can determine why some were destroyed at the terrible judgments that preceded his coming, and what brought others to stand at the temple in the land of Bountiful and thrust their hands into the wounds of his hands and feet. Which group do you want to be in? Do you want to be with the group that gets crispy crittered? I mean, you know, that's kind of an image you don't want to think about. Or do you want to be there when the Savior, do you want to feel the prints of the nails in his hands and his feet, fall at his feet and wet his feet with your tears? I mean, my gracious. We paid extra for these front row seats. Let's get ready. Let's be there. From the Book of Mormon, we learn how disciples of Christ live in times of war, subject of night. From the Book of Mormon, we see the evils of secret combinations portrayed in graphic and chilling reality, subject for the future. In the Book of Mormon, we find lessons for dealing with persecution and apostasy. We learn much about how to do missionary work. And more than anywhere else, we see the Book of Mormon, the dangers of materialism and setting our hearts on the things of the world. That is modern-day America. We're coming into the Christmas season, quote-unquote. There's a presentation I'll be doing next month at another location about the Christmas season during the founding era of this nation. Far different than what we have today. I mean, we have got, as it says here, setting our hearts on the things of the world, going on with President Benson. Can anyone doubt that this book was meant for us and that in it we find great power, great comfort, and great protection? Okay, so wise men, we're going to talk about wise men tonight, not the guys that came on camels that we read about and that were at the Savior's birth. These wise men are mentioned in the Scriptures, and the prophets talk about them, and the Lord himself says he created the Constitution by the hands of wise men. Men he calls wise. Okay, let's read it. And for this purpose have I established the Constitution of this land. This is Doctrine and Covenants 101-80. By the hands of wise men, whom I raised up unto this very purpose, and redeemed the land by the shedding of blood. Okay, in a minute we're going to see section 98, where they says we should elect wise men again. They say it twice in that. Does that mean we're supposed to elect men like the men that founded this nation? I think there's a parallel we could draw there. I think there's an argument we can make. Again, reiterating from something we presented last time, what Brigham said about the Constitution, I want to say to every man, the Constitution of the United States as formed by our fathers was dictated, was revealed, was put into their hearts by the Almighty, who sits enthroned in the midst of the heavens, though all known to them, it was dictated by the revelations of Jesus Christ, and I tell you in the name of Jesus Christ, it is as good as I could ask for. I tell you in the name of Jesus Christ, it's as good as I could ask for. So all these people out there that want to keep changing it, when the 98 section says whatsoever is more or less than that cometh of evil, I have to take a position against that. Here's where we're going to read about that. 98 section, verses 4 through 7. We covered this last time, but you need to know that the 98 section just isn't about endorsement of the Constitution, because it talks about the Lord's rules of engagement for war. We'll get to that in just a minute. Now, verily I say unto you, concerning the laws of the land, is my will that my people should observe to do all things whatsoever I command them. Okay, we understood that already. And that law of the land, which is constitutional, supporting that principle of freedom and maintaining rights and privileges, belongs to all mankind and is justifiable before me. Last time we met, we talked about how that doesn't apply to every constitution in the world. This was given August 6th, 1833. The people were in Missouri. There was constitutional issues that were before the people at that time. I'm not talking about some unwritten constitution in England or France. I'm talking about the United States Constitution. And that's what he was talking about. Verse 6. Therefore I, the Lord, justify you and your brother to my church in befriending that law, which is the constitutional law of the land. He's just endorsed it. He's incorporated it by reference into our religion. Okay? Verse 7, as pertaining to the law of man, whatsoever is more or less than this cometh of evil. We don't need a new constitution. We don't need a change. Now, they've changed it a bunch since 1833, and there's a lot of problems that are going to bite us someday. So a lot of those, I wouldn't feel so bad if they fell off the edge of the earth. But I like what he wrote to begin with. Okay. Now, this is where he refers to wise men twice. Listen carefully. Verse 10. Wherefore, honest men and wise men should be sought for diligently, and good men and wise men ye should observe to uphold. Otherwise, whatsoever is less than these cometh of evil. Do we see that in America today? I think we do. That's my opinion. We don't have wise men in office today. Men that are emulating the words, the deeds, and the principles of the American founding fathers, which God endorsed. He raised them up for that very purpose. He called them wise men. He's endorsing wise men here again. Well, looking presidential is another image thing that we need to get around. We're looking at superficial things. Oh, man, there's always a little distraction. Don't talk to me again, but I'll tell you a little distraction about looking presidential enough. When Samuel, the prophet, was told by the Lord, you know, Saul's kind of messing things up. We got to figure out a new king. So go see this guy. He's got some sons. You better pick one of them to be the king. So we went out, and they had these seven sons. He paraded them before Samuel. No. Don't you have any more sons? Well, I got this kid that's out doing the herd. Bring him in here. Let's see if he's got anything. There he was. He was this ruddy-cheeked boy. He wasn't presidential. He didn't look presidential. But when it came time to stand before Goliath, this 9-foot-6-inch tall guy, I mean, he wasn't just a stick, 9-foot-6. I mean, he had arms and legs and a chest. And this guy was a big dude. And this little boy goes up there against him. But he was not untried in his courage. He had fought lions and bears and stuff like that with his bare hands, basically. And he said, is there not a cause? That's where we are today. Is there not a cause? And most of us think, well, Hans Anderson's going to stay and be the city councilman for Orem. That'll be enough for us. No. We need people standing in the gap, and they're willing to take their place. And maybe everybody's not articulate. Maybe they have another talent. Maybe they know how to run computers, or they maybe know how to make posters, or they maybe know how to bring their friends and family. I don't know, but everybody has to play it. There's an old saying, we don't need passengers in the boat. We need pullers at the oars. We do. Every one of us has to be a puller at the oar. Anyway, I'm distracted again. Number 11, verse 11. I give you a commandment that ye shall forsake all evil and cleave unto all good, and ye shall live by every word which proceedeth forth out of the mouth of God. There's a number of places that's in the scriptures. He's endorsed the Constitution. He says it was given to us by God. And okay, we'll live by every word. He said that also just after he gave us the oath and covenant of the priesthood in the 84th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. We put a lot of stock in that. He's made promises to us. He's making promises to us here. And he's telling us, live by every word. And he's incorporated the Constitution by reference. And we read last time we got together how J. Reuben Clark had a pretty high opinion of it, said it was part of his religion. It was the law of Zion. Okay, let's move on. Okay, now I'm not going to go over in detail Doctrine and Covenants 98, 22 through 48. But I recommend you go home and read it carefully. Because in that little few verses, God details his rules of engagement for warfare. He says, this is how you go to war and why. Okay? He said, this is a very deliberative process. And it is to be deliberative in our nation also, because he gave us the Constitution. He set up Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. We'll read that in a little while. The point of the matter is, it's not something that somebody waves a magic wand like the emperor, the king, or the president and says, I'm going to go do this. It's a clear and present danger against our nation. Well, against the regional peace, or whatever excuse they want to use. there's human rights violations, or the United Nations said, or whatever. We might find weapons of mass destruction, whatever. Those are the four excuses we normally get nowadays in recent history. So we get the United Nations says, we get weapons of mass destruction, we get belligerent talk, and we get human rights violations. Those are the ones that they always put in the resolutions, and we're supposed to wring our hands and weep, but we go off to war. It's supposed to be very deliberative, according to the Lord. You read that, section 98, 22-48. It's supposed to be strictly based upon justice. It is only allowed in defense of circumstances. And we're going to look at instances in the Book of Mormon where this is the case. And we're supposed to raise a standard of peace, not once, not twice, but three times, before the Lord says, you go to war. Those are his rules of engagement in a nutshell. Okay, so the thing that's interesting to me, he makes point of this. He says they're the same today as they were for the Nephites and for all of God's people anciently. Here's where he says this. Behold, this is the law I gave unto my servant Nephi and thy fathers Joseph and Jacob and Isaac and Abraham and all mine ancient prophets and apostles. And again, this is the law that I gave unto mine ancients, that they should not go out unto battle against any nation, kindred, tongue, or people, save I, the Lord, command them. Now, the United Nations doesn't vote on these things when that's happening. And the United Nations, at the end of this, we're going to see, really doesn't have any say anyway. But let's move on. God's laws for war, defensive, non-aggressive, non-preemptive, deliberative, and it was the law anciently, and it is unchanged for us today. He's very specific about this. Okay, so the Book of Mormon tells us that God's war law was adhered to when the people were righteous. But it also testified that when the people didn't abide by his rules of engagement, they suffered the consequences. And even ultimately, they were completely destroyed. We're going to be able to point out a few of these things. Okay, so you might have heard about this guy named Captain Moroni. Captain Moroni, I keep wanting to go back and show you my timeline again, where he lived and when. But he lived many, many years before this guy named Mormon. And Mormon had the assignment of abridging 1,000 years of his people's history. He got to read all their records. He looked at every one of their prophets. He listened to their talks. Well, he didn't listen to them. They didn't have CDs in those days. But he was able to look at the record. He looked at their works and all of the wondrous things they did. And in 1,000 years of his history, he picked one guy to name his son after, Moroni. Now, so far as the scriptures aver, Moroni, Captain Moroni, never held a position in the church. He wasn't even a home teacher. But he had a critical position in maintaining the liberty of his people. Without his efforts, his people would have lost the privilege of worshiping their God and practicing their religion and taking care of their wives and their children and enjoying peace and freedom. We're going to see in a minute that that's in the scriptures. But so anyway, he outlined to the people why we fight defensive wars. He knew the Lamanites were seeking to destroy everything they held sacred. And then in verse 30 here, in this Alma 43, verses 29-30, I say these sometimes. You guys can see what's on the board, but the people that are listening to the audio can't see this. So they have to hear. They go to Alma 43, 29-30. In verse 30, he says it was the only desire of the Nephites to preserve their lands, their liberties, and their church. Okay? Your ability to worship your God according to the dictates of your conscience is currently very, very infringed upon. There didn't have to be an invading alien force. All it was a debauched Supreme Court and legislative enactments and city councils that don't have any backbone. You heard about some tonight earlier. Fact of the matter is, they were trying to defend their privilege of worshiping their God. And he actually says it later in the title of Liberty in chapter 46, verse 12. He says, and it came to pass. He outlines the reasons we go to war. Rent his coat, and he took a piece thereof and wrote on it in memory of our God, our religion and freedom, and our peace, our wives and our children. Okay? So we want to be able to worship our God, practice our religion, enjoy our freedom, which is our agency, which was the baseline issue in the premortal existence. Those two issues are in there in this thing. Was God going to be dethroned or be able to continue to be enthroned? Or was agency to be destroyed or not? That's in there. So we keep God enthroned. We practice our religion. We continue to worship him and do the will of Christ. Freedom is our agency, having peace in order to be able to take care of our wives and children and provide for them as we should do. Okay, that's what this is all about. Now, Moroni, in spite of his great martial capabilities, was not a warmonger. And in the 48th chapter of Alma, we read about Moroni was a strong and a mighty man. He was a man of perfect understanding. Who can say that today? How many men are of perfect understanding? Yea, a man that did not delight in bloodshed, a man whose soul did join the liberty and the freedom of his country and his brethren from bondage and slavery. Yea, a man whose heart did swell with thanksgiving to his God for the many privileges and blessings which he bestowed upon his people, a man who did labor exceedingly for the welfare and safety of his people. Yea, and he was a man who was firm in the faith of Christ, and he had sworn with an oath to defend his people, his rights in his country, and his religion, even to the loss of his blood. Isn't that interesting? Defend. He was not fighting aggressive war. He was driving them from their lands. Going on to verse 17. Yea, verily, verily, I say unto you, if all men had been and were and ever would be like unto Moroni, behold, the very powers of hell would have been shaken forever. Yea, the devil would never have power over the hearts of the children of men. Boy, could we say that about men today? I mean, what? Isn't it astonishing how Satan gets his hooks into us? Okay, now, in that little section that I just read over, Alma chapter 48, embedded kind of within that section, Mormon teaches the Lord's rules of engagement for war. Now, the Nephites were taught to defend themselves against their enemies, even to the shedding of blood if it were necessary. Yea, and they were also taught never to give an offense. Yea, and never to raise the sword except it were against an enemy, except it were to preserve their lives. See, it's a defensive program. And this was their faith. Now, listen to how he handles it. That by so doing, God would prosper them in the land, or in other words, if they were faithful in keeping the commandments of God, that he would prosper them in the land. Yea, warn them to flee or to prepare for war according to their danger. So he's going to prosper them if they're good. Well, this goes clear back into the book of Ether, doesn't it? Oh, wait a minute. It goes clear back into the time of Noah. Oh, wait a minute. It goes clear back to Adam. Because this is the land all that stuff happened in. And this land was set up as a choice land above all other lands if we would but serve the God of the land, who is Jesus Christ. So he's telling us that he's going to take care of you if you're righteous. And then he says, and he'll warn them to flee or to prepare for war according to their danger. See, if you're attuned to God and you're living his commandments, you've got this inside track with him. And yes, sometimes they did have to shed blood. But they only raised a sword and was to defend themselves. Going on to verse 16. And also that God would make it known unto them whether they should go to defend themselves against their enemies. And by so doing, the Lord would deliver them. And this was the faith of Moroni. And his heart did glory in it, not for the shedding of blood, but in doing good and in preserving his people, yea, in keeping the commandments of God, yea, and resisting iniquity. Mormon named his kid Moroni. He thought that much of this guy. Okay, in their times of righteousness, the Nephites were led by righteous men that had the spirit of prophecy and revelation. Here's an example, 3 Nephi chapter 3, verse 19. It was the custom among all the Nephites to appoint for their chief captain, save it in their times of wickedness, someone that had the spirit of revelation and also prophecy. Therefore, this Gidgadoni was a great prophet among them and also was the chief judge. We're going to find out how these great prophets led in war in just a minute. So, as a precursor to that, just look for this. The prophet leaders forbade the taking of the war to the enemy. They didn't run off to the mountains of Afghanistan. If I could be more blunt than that, I would be. But I don't think we really understand what we're doing. We're going to find out when they did that, things didn't go so good for the nation. The prophet leaders warned the people that if they did so, they would be delivered into the hands of their enemies. Here's what happened in 3 Nephi 3, 20 and 21. Now the people said unto Gidgadoni, Pray unto the Lord, and let us go up upon the mountains and into the wilderness, as that we may fall upon the robbers and destroy them in their own lands. But Gidgadoni saith unto them, The Lord forbid. For if we should go up against them, the Lord would deliver us into their hands. Therefore, we will prepare ourselves in the center of our lands, and we will gather all our armies together, and we will not go against them, but we will wait until they shall come against us. Therefore, as the Lord liveth, if we do this, he will deliver them into our hands. Was the Book of Mormon written for those guys or for us? Remember what President Benson said. So, times of righteousness, the people were obedient to the law the Lord established. They did not mount up and go to battle. They brought all their troops home. They closed their borders. They stopped dealing with the enemy until they could play nice. Is there a message in here for us today or not? I mean, think about this for a second. And most of us, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's some even here that think, oh, this is baloney. It's a different world. John Kennedy, back in September 26, 1963, when he came to Salt Lake, gave an exact opposite perspective to this. I have his talk up here, and we're not going to review it. You don't have time. But the fact of the matter is, he denied every one of these things, and he denied all the words of the Founding Fathers, even though he brought them up. He says, I know Washington said this, and I know Jefferson said that. He says, but times have changed. I can't tell you how often I have heard that as I've been out discussing these things in debates that we've been in and so on. So, back to 3 Nephi chapter 3. Yea, he sent a proclamation, this is Gidgadoni, among all the people that they should gather together their women and their children, their flocks and their herds and all their sustenance, substance, save it were their land into one place, and they caused that fortifications should be built around about them. So they took defensive action. This is, by the way, what Jefferson did in the Chesapeake affair when he was president of the United States. He didn't run off to war, even though people were encouraging him to do so, because there had been some actions taken by the British that could be considered to be an aggressive war against them. He took defensive posture. People would say, let's get off to war. And he said, no, it's not my job. That's a congressional responsibility. Legislation must act upon that. He took defensive posture, prepared all he could, took it to the Congress, because he had to get them reassembled, and then presented the matters to them. Okay, that was the way that was done presidentially in the past. Fortifications should be built around about them, and the strength thereof should be exceedingly great, and he caused that armies of both the Nephites and the Lamanites, remember they were kind of combined together, they had kind of had a great conversion, or of all them that were numbered among the Nephites should be placed as guards round about to watch them. He secured the borders and to guard them from the robbers day and night. Yea, he said unto them, as the Lord liveth, except ye repent of all your iniquities and cry unto the Lord, ye will in no wise be delivered out of the hands of those Gadianton robbers. So he kind of made a promise to them. If you guys don't figure out a way to be good, it ain't going to work anyway. It came to pass in the 17th year, the latter end of the year, the proclamation of Laconius had gone forth throughout all the face of the land, and they had taken their horses and their chariots and their cattle and all their flocks. So they took everything. They marched to their gathering place. And they did dwell in one land, as it says in verse 25, one body. They did fear the Lord, the words which had been spoken by Laconius, insomuch that they did repent of all their sins. And they put up their prayers to the Lord their God. So they turned to God. Did President Kimball talk about this? He didn't talk about it right at the beginning of my presentation. He talked about it in 1976, but I presented it again here tonight. He says, you know, we become anti-enemy instead of pro-kingdom of God. The people in the Book of Mormon became pro-kingdom of God. It's interesting. Okay, now this wasn't always the case. They didn't always have righteous leaders. And if you look in Helaman chapter 5, verses 1 through 3, you'll find an instance where the people voted out a righteous leader. Now, a lot of people think that this was like when Alma turned over the judgment seat so that he could go preach the gospel all the time. You need to carefully read this section. Cezorum was a wicked man, and you can even read about that in the index of the Book of Mormon if you want to. He was part of the secret combinations. Read carefully their involvement in how the secret combinations in this section had taken control of the government. Nephi had been the chief judge. He was voted out of office. And we'll read about this. And it came to pass that the same year, behold, Nephi delivered up the judgment seat to a man whose name was Cezorim. People say, oh, well, he just kind of cared. Right? Hey, Cezorim, come in here. Take my place. I'm going to go be a prophet. No. For their laws and their governments were established by the voice of the people. The people chose. And they who chose evil were more numerous than they who chose good. Therefore, they were ripening for destruction, for the laws had become corrupted. Yea, no, this was not all. They were stiff-necked people, insomuch that they would not be governed by the law nor justice, save it was to their destruction. See, the people today oftentimes will not be governed by the law that God gave us. This United States Constitution, limits, bounds, checks, balances, separation of powers, all of these kinds of things, we don't even seem to care about that anymore as a people. And when the president, by fiat, decides he's only going to apply these laws and not those, he's going to change them on a whim. You've seen this happen in the last few days, haven't you? Okay? He can't do that. He has no legislative authority, but we're stiff-necked enough. We can't be governed by a law. We're just going to take a seat of our pants, whatever. We're going to get it in the seat of the pants, I'm afraid, at any rate. Okay, so Mosiah had warned about this at the time he established the Constitutional Republic. He says, if you forget and you abandon correct principles and the voice of the people chooses this, we got big troubles. Here's what he said. And if the time, this is Mosiah chapter 29. And if the time comes that the voice of the people doth choose iniquity, then is the time that the judgments of God will come upon you. Yea, then is the time he will visit you with great destruction, even as hitherto visited this land. What's hitherto? I mean, they'd had a pretty good time up until this point, hadn't they? He knew about the Jaredites and their destruction. He knew about how the land had been cleansed during the floods. He says, yeah, you're going to see some bad things happen if you don't keep the line. Okay. So the time came, in spite of all their efforts of guys like Mormon and Moroni, the people abandoned righteousness. They abandoned God's rules of engagement regarding war, and they went off and did what they darn well pleased. And so we read in Mormon chapter 3, verses 10 and 14 through 15, and they did swear by the heavens. This is when Mormon was their leader. Remember, the prophet came to him when he was 10 years old and said, I perceive that thou art a sober child and quick to observe. Think of how many 10-year-olds you know about that. How many teach primary? And you got 10-year-olds. I mean, keeping them focused for 15 seconds is a big deal sometimes. Some of you are about 10? No. Anyway. He says, when you get a little bit older, you're going to have to get these records in, abridge them, all this kind of stuff. And when he's 15, he's leading the Nephite armies. Good grief. Oh, my gracious. Anyway, he led them on and off because of all of the challenges they had, and he had bailed for a while because he got sick and tired of trying to get a people that were so hard-hearted and stubborn. He kept coming back and trying to save them. He loved them. Okay, they did swear, this is the people of Nephi, they did swear by the heavens and also the throne of God that they would go up to battle against their enemies and would cut them off from the face of the land. And when they had sworn by all that had been forbidden them, by our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, that they would go up unto their enemies to battle and avenge themselves of the blood of their brethren. Behold, the voice of the Lord came unto me, saying, vengeance is mine, and I will repay. And because this people repented not after I delivered them, behold, they shall be cut off from the face of the earth. People just said, we're not going to listen to the Lord anymore. So we go over to the next chapter, Mormon 4, verses 4 and 5 and 18. It was because the armies of the Nephites went up to the Lamanites that they began to be smitten. For were it not for that, the Lamanites could have had no power over them. But behold, the judgments of God will overtake the wicked, and it is by the wicked that the wicked are punished. For it is the wicked that stir up the hearts of the children unto bloodshed. And from this time forth did the Nephites gain no power over the Lamanites, but began to be swept off by them, even as the dew before the sun. So when they'd abandoned his principles, you can't say all bets were off because the Lord wasn't betting man, but all of the rules of engagement, all the things that had to follow on, followed on. So, and then near the end of the destruction of the people of Nephi, this is what Mormon wrote to the Lamanites. Again, it was written for us today because the Lamanites in his day were never going to get this. You must come to repentance or you cannot be saved. Know that you must lay down your weapons of war and delight no more in the shedding of blood and take them not again, save it be that God shall command you. It goes back to that 98 section of the Doctrine and Covenants. We go under the Lord's rules, and that's it. Okay, remember, in the scriptures we talk about the wise men that God recommended we choose as leaders. Now we're going to come back to them, okay? Remember this, we talk about wise men in the 98th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, and then living by every word that proceedeth forth from the mouth of God. Okay. Who did God call as wise men? Well, we've already talked about this. You know the answers, okay? I have established the Constitution and wise men whom I raised up. 101st section, verse 80 again, okay? So, that's what we're talking about. What did these wise guys have to say about this greatest of all obscenities called war that could be compelled on a nation from time to time? What did those wise men that God raised up have to say? Because he endorsed them. He gave them wisdom and understanding and all the things that were necessary to bring forth this great nation. So, let's go to the Constitution that God actually dictated to them, which is what Brigham Young said and how we understand. The Founding Fathers even felt this. You know, they didn't talk about an angel appearing to them and dictating it, but they felt the hand of God upon them as they did this. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 says, Congress shall have power to declare war. Congress shall have power. It's close to the people. It's still a Republican form of government, not anything to do with the Republican Party, but it has to do with the representative form of government. The people are representing the people, and that's why we need to put wise men in those jobs so that they do the right thing. Not self-serving, egotistical, power-mongering, whatever you want to describe them like. They are to be men of understanding. And I might have mentioned this to you before about how they have to be men with teeth. Not to be mean, but they got to be able to chew their own meat. They got to be able to walk and think and not have to be carried from place to place by those of us that care about these things. They've got to be men of sound understanding. Oh, didn't we talk about Moroni having that kind of background? A perfect understanding even. That's the kind of people we need. And when I find that we've got to beg and cajole and grovel before these people that we put in office in order to even get them to think about these things, they're not chewing their own meat. They haven't matured enough to understand the correct principles. So, that's why Congress is to have the power to declare war, not the president. We're going to see why in just a minute. So what does it mean? Well, Alexander Hamilton, first let's back up. Federalist Papers were 85 essays written by Hamilton, Jay, and Madison. John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison. To help the people understand the principles embodied in the United States Constitution and to help facilitate the ratification of the Constitution. You need to read them, okay? I wish Madison had written more than he did, but he only wrote what he wrote. Alexander Hamilton wrote the 69th paper, and he explained the war-making powers that were granted to the President of the United States within the Constitution. Here's what he wrote. The President is to be the Commander-in-Chief, now he's quoting from the Constitution, Commander-in-Chief of the Army of Navy of the United States, of the militia of the several states, when called into the actual service of the United States. The president will only have the occasional command of such part of the militia of the nation as by legislative provision may be called into the actual service of the Union. Who are the militia? This could get us off on a tangent very easily here. The militia is all of us, basically. George Mason, the guy who wrote the Second Amendment with James Madison, defined the militia as everyone except for a few elected officials. Okay, so the president can only have, by the way, I don't want to be one of those elected officials because I want to help defend our liberty. Of course, I guess if you're an elected official, you make good choices and we'll be better off. But at any rate, so the president's only going to have command of the militia when Congress says, okay? But here's one of the key points. The president is to be the commander-in-chief of the Army, the Navy, of the United States. It would amount to nothing more than the supreme command and direction of the military and naval forces as first general and admiral. Do generals and admirals decide when we're going to war? No. The president doesn't either. He's like the military leader when we're actually in a warfare environment. Of course, you're not going to find those guys on the front lines. In fact, most everybody from major on up used to bail out in Vietnam whenever incoming started. They'd jump on their helicopters and get out of there. But so we didn't, senior officers normally don't take many risks. Last war that really happened was probably in Korea. But at any rate, then regarding declaring a war and the raising and regulating of fleets and armies, all of which by the Constitution under consideration would appertain to the legislature. All of that stuff has to do with the legislature. Whether you're declaring war, raising army or navy or whatever, the legislative power is there. The president does not make the rules of engagement of war. The president does not control what you do with captures in war. That would include prisoners of war. Have you heard of Guantanamo Bay? Okay. You've heard about the prison we have there? And the president's incarcerating people there? Who really has control over those captures in war? The Congress. So we don't have very courageous people out there anymore. But anyway, 69th Federalist Paper says the president's just the first admiral or general. He does not declare war and does have no authority to do so. And we're going to find that, St. George Tucker's going to say something, then we're going to remember the president does have the authority, it's legislative, and we're going to see constitutional protocol absolutely says you cannot redelegate a power granted in the Constitution. So when Congress has a power, they can't redelegate that to anybody else. We'll read that in just a minute. But here's what St. George Tucker said. Now, St. George Tucker has kind of a strange name. I cheer his reading and writings constantly. And after you've read, the Constitution and the Farewell Address and the Federalist Papers, then read his book called View of the Constitution of the United States. You've got to kind of get an understanding of the language they spoke. Because St. George Tucker was probably the preeminent constitutional scholar of the founding era. And here's what he said about war. The power declaring war with all its train of consequences and direct and indirect forms the next branch of the powers confided to Congress. And happy it is for the people of America that it is so vested. The term war embraces the extremes of human misery and iniquity and is alike the offspring of the one and the parent of the other. What else is the history of war from the earliest stages to the present moment but an afflicting detail of the suffering and calamities of mankind resulting from the ambition, usurpation, animosities, resentment, piques, intrigues, avarice, rapacity, oppressions, murders, assassinations, and other crimes of the few possessing power. How rare are the instances of a just war? How few of those which are thus denominated have had their existence in a national injury? See, so most of the wars start not because of a national injury. It's because, as it goes on, the personal claims of the sovereign are confounded with the interests of the nation over which he presides, and his private grievances or complaints are transferred to the people, who are thus made the victims of a quarrel in which they have no part until they become principals of it by their sufferings. See, this is the founders were really, really, really great students of history. And they watched what happened all across the nations of the world throughout history. They found that when an emperor, a king, a prince, or whoever got offended, he took his nation to war and let his people shed their blood. And he took their fortune from them in order to pay for these things. He said, most of the wars aren't just. And we need to establish it on a better footing, going on with this statement. War would be banished from the face of the earth, were nations instead of princes to decide upon their necessity. Injustice can never be the collective sentiment of a people emerged from barbarism. Happy the nation, where the people are the arbiters of their own interest and their own conduct. Happy were it for the world, did the people of all nations possess this power. He's saying, if every nation in the world was able to separate their wars from their leaders and really recognize them for what they were, we'd be a lot better off. So he's saying, we got that in America. That's what our Constitution recognizes. It's so magnificent. Here's this guy named Locke, John Locke. He was one of the principal founders of the nation, although he had nothing whatsoever to do with establishing our government, except for the fact that he was the tutor, if you will, with his writings for the founding fathers. They all studied the works of Locke and Blackstone as they were growing up. Okay, and Locke said, this is that powers can't be redelegated. The legislative cannot transfer the power of making laws to any other hands, for it being but a delegated power from the people, they who have it cannot pass it over to others. The people alone can appoint the forms of the commonwealth, which is by constituting the legislative and appointing in whose hands that power shall be. And when the people have said, we will submit and be governed by laws made by such men in such forms, nobody else can say other men shall make laws for them. Nor can they be bound by any laws but such as are enacted by those whom they have chosen and authorized to make laws for them. And what does the Constitution say about this? Article 1, Section 1, first breath out of their mouth, that all legislative authority herein granted belongs to what? House and the Senate. Okay. It's interesting that here a year ago, the House and the Senate went out of business for a while. Well, they finished up their session. They had passed 90 laws. And not all of them were constitutional by any means, but they had passed 90 laws. Do you know how many laws were passed by the executive branch through executive order, through administrative law, and all sorts of the shenanigans that they pull off? The EPA, the FDA, the IRS, the BATFE, you can name the alphabet soups as good as I can. Four times as many. And it's saying here, but you know what? You can't be bound. This is what John Locke said, you can't be bound by laws that are passed by those you haven't authorized to do them. And we keep lumping along because we don't know or we don't care or something. I don't know what it is. But four times the laws that the House and the Senate passed were passed in the executive branch under administrative law or by executive order. Okay. And there were also not exactly the same number, but a similar kind of number that was passed by the judicial through judicial activism. Okay, Tucker agreed with what Locke said and said a delegated authority cannot be transferred to another to exercise. I mean, that's saying it very succinctly. Okay, so Thomas Jefferson said, you know what? As he read the Constitution, he said, we have placed the president, constraints on the president in regards to the war-making power. And I almost wrote a book about this one time, and I may someday, but here's what I was going to call it, Chaining the Dog of War. It sounds like such an image, doesn't it? Anyway, Jefferson said, we have already given an example, one effectual check on the dog of war. By transferring the power of declaring war from the executive to the legislative body, from those who are to spend to those who are to pay. So he chained that dog of war, the executive, by the Constitution. James Madison, the father of the Constitution, he warned about these expansive powers that were going to come if we had wars and how the executive branch ought to be contained from those things. He said, in time of actual war, he said this, by the way, during the Federal Convention. A relatively young man, we're going to see on the next statement that he really continued with this belief his whole life, to the end of his life. He said, In time of actual war, great discretionary powers are constantly given to the executive magistrate. Constant apprehension of war has the same tendency to render the head too large for the body. By the way, are we told that we're in a war on terrorism that's going to be generational? Yeah. So this is constant apprehension of war has the tendency to render the head too large for the body. Going on with the statement, a standing military force with an overgrown executive, well, there's an image for you, will not long be safe companions to liberty. The means of defense against foreign danger have always been the instruments of tyranny at home. Can you say homeland security? Can you say the NSA side at Bluffdale? Can you say the Patriot Act? Can you say the Military Commissions Act? I mean, we go on and on and on, don't we? It's because of it's this idea, this means of defense against foreign danger will always be the instruments of tyranny at home. We are so concerned. I mean, the people wring their hands in impotent despair that the NSA was listening in on conversations of people overseas. And we, without a whimper, roll over when our Fourth Amendment is completely destroyed. This privacy, security, and papers and things, you know, that we talk about in the Fourth Amendment. It's astonishing to me. We're worried we need to apologize to our allies. Well, what about us? We're the people that put them there. Oh, my gracious. Anyway, among the Romans, it was a standing maximum to excite a war whenever a revolt was apprehended. Throughout all Europe, the armies, kept under the pretext of defending, have enslaved the people. That's why they didn't want standing armies. James Madison, this is later on in life. This is in the fourth volume of his writings. Of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. See, they keep telling us all the evil is tied to war. Now, we can go do evil on our own. Sure, that's absolute. But when we get in war, it magnifies all the others. Okay. War is the parent of armies, and from these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments to bring the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual war. Generational, they told us. 9/11, 2001, from now on, your great-great-great-grandchildren are going to be involved in this. Look how successful we've been on the war of poverty and the war on drugs and all these other things. I mean, good grief. Anyway. Okay, so George Washington counseled against involving the nation in foreign wars. He says, Europe has a set of primary interests. By the way, that was who we'd had most of our dealings with, Europe, which have none or very remote relation. Hence, she must be engaged in frequent controversies, the cause of which are essentially foreign to our concerns. Hence, therefore, it must be unwise in us to implicate ourselves by artificial ties in the ordinary vicissitudes of her politics or the ordinary combinations and collusions of her friendships or enmities. Can you say NATO? North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Can you say CETO? Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. Can you say CENTO? I mean, this is the central. Okay, we are embracing all of the enmities that every other nation in the world has when we enter into these treaties. We're going to see in a while, well, I'm going to be reminded to it by a quote by John Kennedy that I have in here. But Kennedy, in his Salt Lake talk on the 26th of September, absolutely embraced every one of those things and us being involved in all of those things. Going on with George Washington, why forego the advantage of so peculiar a situation? Why quit our own to stand upon foreign ground? Why, by interweaving our destiny with that of any part of Europe, entangle our peace and prosperity in the toils of European ambition, rivalship, interest, humor, or caprice? Thomas Jefferson counseled against these kind of alliances that would draw us into war. Jefferson again, we got several by Jefferson. I have deemed it fundamental for the United States never to take part in the quarrels of Europe. Their political interests are entirely distinct from ours. Their mutual jealousies, their balance of power, their complicated alliances. By the way, those complicated alliances are what brought about World War I. Someday maybe we'll talk about that. It's astounding. Millions of people died over these complicated alliances and that one thing that was triggered. Their forms and principles of government are all foreign to us. They are nations of eternal war. I am for free commerce with all nations, political connection with none, and little or no diplomatic establishment. I am not for linking ourselves by new treaties with the quarrels of Europe, entering the field of slaughter to preserve their balance, or joining in the confederacy of kings to war against the principles of liberty. Now, why are all these guys in here? Remember, wise men whom I raised up for this very purpose. I'm quoting the guys that God raised up, okay? He said, Jefferson also said, commerce with all nations, alliance with none should be our motto. I deem it one of the essential principles of government and consequently one which ought to shape its administration. Peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations entangled in alliance with none. By the way, in that 26th of September talk that John Kennedy gave in Salt Lake, he refers to these things. And then he says, we're in a different time. We're going to do it different. John Quincy Adams, son of John Adams, counseled against intervening in the wars of other nations, even if they're for things we believe in. Here's what he said in the July 4th, 1821. America has abstained from interference in the concerns of others even when the conflict has been for principles to which she clings. She goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. Okay, now the Monroe Doctrine formalized this policy as one of non-interventionism in the United States. And by the way, J. Reuben Clark wrote a magnificent paper on it. You ought to read it sometime. It's a little over 1,000 pages. And you'll find it a very wonderful exposition on these things. It's a white paper on Monroe Doctrine. I can't remember the exact title, but J. Reuben Clark wrote it. Okay, here's what the Monroe Doctrine said. In the wars of European powers and matters relating to themselves, we have never taken any part, nor does it comport with our policy to do so. Our policy in regard to Europe is not to interfere in the internal concerns of any of its powers. I've got James Monroe there and James Madison there because James Madison helped write it. Okay, so George Washington's farewell address. He talks about these things. He talks about if we, there's so many things in foreign intrigue and all that kind of stuff. Brian, are we going to have to stop in relative near term? Okay, good. I'm going to not watch Brian anymore tonight. he was pacing. I'm worried about it. What's that, Brian? Okay, so war and foreign policy, very, very, very heavily covered by George Washington in his farewell address. I wished everybody in the morning when they got up, if they were a congressman or senator in Washington, would say their morning prayers, they would read their scriptures, they would read the Constitution of the United States, they'd read the farewell address, and then they'd go to work. Keep them out of our hair more, but it would also help maybe remind them of the principles that they've got to hold sacred. So, here's out of his farewell address. Avoid the necessity of those overgrown military establishments which under any form of government are inauspicious to liberty and which are to be regarded as particularly hostile to Republican liberty. Observe good faith and justice toward all nations. Cultivate peace and harmony with all. Religion and morality enjoin this conduct. See, he talks about religion and morality regularly. Can it be that Providence, meaning God, has not connected the permanent felicity of a nation with its virtue? Nothing is more essential than permanent, inveterate antipathies, that means kind of antagonism, against particular nations and passionate attachments to others should be excluded. If you wanted to, we could talk, and I'm not going to be really direct on this except for when I give this John Kennedy thing in a minute, because we can see the outcome of that. But we have nations in the world that we would go to the mat for anything. We will go bomb, shock and awe, and everything else at the request of these nations. And here he's saying, don't go there. Reading on. Just and amicable feelings towards all should be cultivated. The nation which indulges towards another an habitual hatred or an habitual fondness is in some degree a slave. It is a slave to its animosity or to its affection, either of which is sufficient to lead it astray from its duty and its interest. Antipathy in one nation against another disposes each more readily to offer insult and injury, to lay hold of slight causes of umbrage, and to be haughty and intractable when accidental or trifling occasions of dispute occur. Hence, frequent collisions, obstinate, envenomed, and bloody contest. The nation, prompted by ill will and resentment, sometimes impels to war the government. Likewise, a passionate attachment of one nation for another produces a variety of evils. Sympathy for the favorite nation, facilitating the illusion of an imaginary common interest in cases where no real common interest exists, infusing into one the enmities of the other, betrays the former into participation in the quarrels and wars of the latter without adequate inducement or justification. It leads also to concessions to the favorite nation of privileges denied to others, which is apt doubly to injure the nation, making the concessions by unnecessarily parting with what ought to have been retained and by exciting jealousy, ill will, and disposition to retaliate. So he's saying, don't go to this favorite nation stuff that we're going to, you know, go fight their wars for, whatever, okay? An example of all of this stuff, and we're going to go on in just a minute, but I'm intervening with something about what John Kennedy said about this favoritism and how it can lead to fatal flaws. Now, we know where this one led. There are others that are brewing today that will, I fear, and I was going to say predict, but I'm not going to try and be a prophet at this time, but I would fear will have a similar outcome. John F. Kennedy made this following statement, and we were blindly devoted to it. And some of us lost really good friends because of it, okay? Vietnam represents a test of American responsibility and determination in Asia. If we are not the parents of little Vietnam, then surely we are the godparents. We presided at its birth. We gave assistance to its life. We have helped it to shape its future. As French influence in the political, economic, and military spheres has declined in Vietnam, American influence has steadily grown. This is our offspring. We cannot abandon it. We cannot ignore its needs. And if it falls victim to any of the perils that threaten its existence, communism, political anarchy, poverty, and the rest, then the United States will, with some justification, will be held responsible, and our prestige in Asia will sink to a new low. Okay? Over the next 19 years, we had 55,000 of our American guys get killed there, tens of thousands more get maimed, and the political fortunes of the nation, where is Vietnam right now? I wish there was time to talk about the coups of Diem and Big Minh and all those kind of things, and Key and the corruption of Vietnam and all this kind of stuff. It is astounding that we put all of our political and economic and military power and the blood, fortune, and lives of our people on the line for some nation so unworthy of it. And it's just tragic. At any rate, I told you about the 26th of September and when he spoke in Salt Lake. There were three nations particularly that he mentioned there. He mentioned Vietnam, he mentioned Congo, and he mentioned Yemen. And how the United Nations had to intervene in these things. And by the way, the United Nations war was involved in the Vietnamese War. It was through CETO, Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, which was simply a regional arrangement under the United Nations. You can read the United Nations Charter if you want. CETO was how we fought the war. We informed the Security Council of all of our major activities in advance of them doing us. Who led the Security Council's military side? It was a communist from Russia. Okay? So they knew in advance of all the things that we were doing. At any rate, Kennedy in Salt Lake on the 26th of September 1963 said, we have to do these things. It requires it. The United Nations, I support them. The Congo, probably most here have never heard of Katanga. It was a province in the Congo. It was a Christian province. It was based upon Christian Western principles of liberty. And they had broken off from the Congo. When the Congo was being put under a Marxist regime, Katanga says, no, we ain't going to be part of this. And we helped bomb them back into the Congo. So Vietnam, the Congo, and Yemen are all Leninist, Marxist regimes now. And Kennedy's position was, we have to do this in order to save them from that. And it's like, get the bigger government going and all this kind of stuff. It was so astounding what he said in the tabernacle on the 26th of September, 1963. Again, I have his talk up here if anybody wants to glance at it. But the fact of the matter is, him quoting our founders and everything else, he says, we're going to go another path. We're not going to go that way. So, anyway, going back to Washington's farewell address, it gives to ambitious, corrupted, or deluded citizens who devote themselves to the favorite nation facility to betray or sacrifice the interests of their own country without odium, sometimes even with popularity. That's what he said. So we get these favorite nations, and we're going to go to the mat for them, and we're going to sell them our military secrets, we're going to give them military support, we're going to actually go to war on their behalf. Although we usually don't say that outright, but it's embedded in, for example, that Senate Joint Resolution a year ago in September. Who are we going to war against Iran for? Israel. That's exactly who it was for. Because the belligerent, bellicose verbiage that was coming out of Iran, Israel was saying, straighten them out. They were shaking the chain of our dog of war. I'm going to turn it loose. Okay, so we even betray our own country without odium, sometimes with even popularity, is what George Washington said. Such attachments are particularly alarming to the truly enlightened and independent patriot. I hope that's all you. How many opportunities they afford to tamper with domestic factions, to practice the arts of seduction, to mislead public opinion, to influence or awe the public councils. Such an attachment, meaning to these other nations, of a small or weak towards a great and powerful nation dooms the former to be a satellite of the latter. So are we sometimes a satellite if they're telling us to go to war and we decide to? Yeah. Against the insidious wiles of foreign influence, I conjure you to believe me, fellow citizens. The jealousy of a free people ought to be constantly awake, since history and experience prove that foreign influence is one of the most baneful foes of republican government. Excessive partiality for one foreign nation and excessive dislike for another cause those whom they actuate to see danger only on one side and serve to veil and even second the arts of influence on the other. Wow. Real patriots who may resist the intrigues of the favorite are liable to become suspected and odious, while its tools and dupes usurp the applause and confidence of the people to surrender their interests. The great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations is, in extending our commercial relations, to have with them as little political connection as possible. Europe, well, we already read this about Europe. It was in that slide several ago. And he says, why forego the advantage of so peculiar a situation? We've read that. It is to our true policy to steer clear of the permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world. 'Tis folly in one nation to look for disinterested favors from another, that it must pay with a portion of its independence for whatever it may accept under that character. So that's what the wise men that God raised up to establish this nation said about war and foreign alliances and intrigue like that, all that stuff. So it reflects what our Latter-day prophets and apostles have said to us Latter-day saints. Here's what J. Reuben Clark said in April 1937 in General Conference, for direct speech again. There was a war brewing, okay, in Europe. Remember when, maybe you don't remember, but you've read about it, when Russia and Hitler put together a secret non-aggression pact in August of 1939. And then on September 1st of 1939, Hitler invaded from the west. About 2 weeks later, Stalin came in from the east into Poland. That non-aggression pact said they were going to divide up Europe. Hitler had his Western European countries he was going to be allowed under this, and Stalin had his Eastern European countries he was going to be allowed under this. They agreed to that. Okay? That was 2 years after. More than 2 years after J. Reuben Clark said this in General Conference in pleading with the people. He came back in 1938 and continued his plea with the people. I don't have that in here at this point. But you can see that it was multiple times that he pled with the people. He said, "Nevertheless, there is strongest reason for believing that some of the most skilled, astute, and shrewd diplomats, politicians, and statesmen of all Europe are now planning to have the people of the United States finance the next European war, either before the war begins or during its progress." What a prophetic statement. Let's go on with it. "Furthermore, certain of these diplomats, politicians, and statesmen are planning to entice the United States into an offensive and defensive military alliance in order that we shall participate in that next world war by sending our young men to the battlefields of Europe. The argument they now plan to use to bring this about is that in this way only can the peace of the world be preserved." How many times today do we hear that same argument? "Oh, we've got to go over there. We've got to be there, or else it's not going to be peaceful anymore. We're going to go have a war to be peaceful." It just never makes any sense to me. But at any rate, that's what they were saying back in the 1930s. J. Reuben Clark saw through that. He pled with the saints, "Don't go there," going on with his statement. "While this is a most profound fallacy," it still is, by the way, my parenthetical comment, "it will unfortunately find a sympathetic ear among many of the people of this country who do not fully understand international relations. It will require the wisest statesmanship," there's that wise guy again, "on our part to prevent the United States from becoming again the victim of a world military catastrophe." Just a few years later, 55 million people had been killed over this whole mess. By the way, that's how many we've killed in our own country since 1973 when we legalized abortion. We've killed as many people in our own country in a time of peace. Again, this is a side trip, I guess. In a time of peace, in our most prosperous circumstances, we've killed over 55 million of our own people in our own country. Those that have never drawn a breath of life, the most innocent, the most defenseless of all of us, and it's just fine with most people. I was in a gospel doctrine class here a while ago when the leader of the class said, we believe in obeying, honoring, and staying in the law. What's that? 12th article, right? And the law of the land is abortion, so we go along with that. And of course, that lit me up a little bit. But I had a comment. And so it took a little bit of the class to get over that point. But the fact of the matter is, 55 million, a generation, has been destroyed. A generation that would have been my children's classmates or friends or teammates or whatever. It's astounding to me. And it continues, unabated. And this life, liberty stuff, anyway. So we strain at gnats and swallow camels. We go off on the war drum beating and we run off and doing other wicked things. It's just astounding to me. At any rate, so there's J. Reuben Clark, 1937. And I got to tell you that this next quotation, I carried the whole conference talk with me while I was in the military. I carried it in my fatigue pocket on my heart, over my heart. It helped me make sense of things, and I really recommend it to you to read it. It's a very pragmatic approach because J. Reuben Clark had pled with us to not get involved in the war in the 1930s, right? War came around December 7, 1941. War was declared December 8, 1941. The United States was thrust into it. What are they going to say? We ain't going? He's going to say, you don't have power to stop it now. And he's saying in this next statement, now the whole conference talk is marvelous. He talks about how the time is going to come when we will have about as good of medical care within our communities because of this war, because they're going to take all the doctors and nurses into the war effort. You're going to, as parents, have to become basically your children's caretakers. And he gives pragmatic advice about proper meals and dressing properly and enough rest and liquids and all those kind of things. So it's a talk but it is a message of the First Presidency they gave April Conference 1942 because the war had now started. And I only put this little bit in here because there are those here in this room that served. And are you at fault for these things? Should we besmirch you? And the answer is no. And like I say, I carried this in my pocket all the time. And here's just a little snippet of what he said. When therefore constitutional law, now by the way, I put that in bold. Why? Because we haven't very often had a constitutional law lately. I mean, a constitutional war lately, have we? And I think to me that's a little bit of he was thinking. He was thinking that someday there's going to come when they're going to start pulling these shenanigans without going about them properly. But he said, when therefore constitutional law, obedient to these principles, calls the manhood of the church into the armed services of any country to which they owe allegiance, their highest civic duty requires that they meet that call. If, hearkening to that call and obeying those in command over them, they shall take the lives of those who fight against them, that will not make them murderers, nor subject them to the penalty that God has prescribed. For those who kill beyond the principle will be mentioned shortly. Oh, okay, by the way, he doesn't give a free pass to those that become involved in war crimes, to those that are, and there were guys that I knew that during this thing in Southeast Asia resorted to war crimes to do the things that they do interrogations, for example. And by the way, just as a side note, good grief, we're going to have to hurry. We're almost done, I promise you. Waterboarding. Who was the instigator of all that nonsense? Well, you go back into what they called the Philippine insurrection. What was that? It was a follow-on to the Spanish-American War. The Spanish-American War, the United States, quote-unquote, and I wished we had time to talk about what really happened in the Spanish-American War, but we liberated the Philippines from the Spanish. Now, there was a leader, a natural leader of the Philippines there that loved the United States, loved the Constitution, loved the Declaration of Independence, and he was warned against allowing the Americans to come ashore during that because the warning was that they will subject you. And he said, I have read the Constitution and the Declaration. There is nothing in that that allows that. I think we can trust them. He allowed them. We took over the country. They were basically a colony of the United States for many years. And the people of the Philippines, well, we're saying, oh, we're going to Christianize them. Well, the Catholics had been there for a lot of years, and most of the nation was already Christian. They'd been converted to Catholicism. Anyway, I don't want to get too far afield. But in our, there was an insurrection against our occupation of the Philippines. And by the way, I hope that if foreign powers occupied our nation, that there would be people here that would be upset about that, that would resist that. And what we're reading in the newspaper today is that we're coming to a quote-unquote security arrangement with Afghanistan to keep our forces there for an extended period of time. Well, how would you feel if people brought, I don't know, Russians, Chinese, Mexicans, English, somebody from Africa, somebody from the Middle East? I don't care. You pick a country that's going to be patrolling our streets with M16s and maybe AK-47s in their case, whatever, with RPGs and raiding our homes at night and terrifying our wives and our children. How would you feel about that? I mean, you don't think that there are, I mean, I hope and pray there's enough manhood left in this country that we would say, oh, over my dead body. But we're negotiating these things around the world to provide security for all of them. Someday it may happen here. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that we're kind of off base on this thing. And getting back to waterboarding, that's what I ought to do just to get back on track here so we can end on time. Thousands of times in the Philippines, the American forces waterboarded, they called it the water treatment, the village leaders of the Philippines. We taught them the principles. And by the way, about a third of them died that we instigated it on. It's as close to drowning as you're going to get without drowning if you have proper medical care handy. So we waterboarded the Filipino leadership through this insurrection. Okay? When Japan got into the, by the way, well, we don't have time to go into how we encouraged World War II clear back as the beginning of the 20th century, back in the early 1900s. But that's another story perhaps we ought to tell. The Japanese applied waterboarding, and we had war criminals trials for them using waterboarding on Allied prisoners. Okay? Phnom Penh, some of you have heard of Cambodia? Okay? You remember when the Khmer Rouge took control of Phnom Penh and Cambodia and they tortured and murdered about a third of the population of the country? You might have heard about this. They have a museum in Phnom Penh now. They wanted to capture the idea of this torturous regime that was there. And they have a room there that's dedicated to waterboarding. They show how the people were waterboarded by the communist leaders. Kind of an interesting thing. So here what President J. Reuben Clark is giving is not a blank check to anybody that goes to war. You know, you have to go to war, you have to perform your duty, he's saying, and later on in the talk he says, don't go off the deep end. He talks about those. Okay, so he says, should be mentioned shortly, for it would be a cruel God that would punish his children as moral sinners for acts done by them as the innocent instrumentalities of a sovereign whom he had told them to obey and whose will they were powerless to resist. So anyway, that's part of the talk he gave in April of 1942. I recommend you get the whole talk. Okay, so if you're called to serve, there was many that really answered the call. They fought the wars, and those wars violated the rules of engagement. Many lost their lives, their limbs, their peace of mind. Many paid a terrible price, and they're still continuing to do that. The point is not that they were wrong defending their nation when they were called, or that their sorrows or burdens are not without merit or appreciated by those of us that are left. The point is, however, that men in high places, men in places of trust and confidence, often violate their sacred honor and duty in regards to war, and that men in high places make decisions which lead to consequences which really are repugnant crimes. The point is also that we must choose wise leaders, because as a free people, we're held responsible for the actions of government that we choose. Okay, you can read about that in the 134th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, verse 1. It says, governments were instituted of God for the benefit of man. We talked about this last time we were together. And he holds men accountable for their acts in relation to them, both in making and administering them. Okay. And the point is that according to Mosiah chapter 29, verse 30, that in a free land where agency exists, if the people commit sins and iniquities, they'll be answered upon their own heads. The point is that according to the 101st section of the Doctrine and Covenants, verse 78, the Constitution established by God in this land requires that every man be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment. Now, we're not in the majority oftentimes, and so we've just got to make sure that we make popular that which is sound and good and unpopular that which is unsound. That's what Joseph Smith said. That's what Ezra Taft Benson said. So we've got to try and make principles popular. We've got to seek to uphold these correct principles in government at all times, particularly those that are members of the church. We've got to get rid of modern-day entangled alliances that take us into wars that we shouldn't be in. And these wars violate the rules of engagement. We're taken in because NATO said, or because CETO said, or because the United Nations said. And we could point out numerous examples in the last 20 years that we've become involved in those things. Here's what J. Reuben Clark said of the United Nations Charter. There's no provision in the Charter itself that contemplates ending war. The Charter is built to prepare for war, not to promote peace. The Charter is a war document, not a peace document. It doesn't prevent future wars. It takes from us the power to declare them, to choose the side on which we shall fight, to determine what forces and military equipment we shall use in the war, and to control and command our sons who do the fighting. So we're no longer in charge of our own destiny or in how we're going to engage in accordance to God's rules. Ezra Taft Benson was talking about that analysis that J. Reuben Clark made of the United Nations, and he said this about that analysis. He continues with a devastating analysis of a sober warning of the American to the American people that there will be a day of reckoning. I believe that that day is near at hand. The hopes and the aspirations of the people have been betrayed. And there's the reference on that. Out of the, if you probably don't have the title of Liberty, but you've got the teachings of Ezra Taft Benson, page 698. He goes on to write, on the surface, the United Nations Charter and the structure of its various departments bears a strong resemblance to those of our own federal government, but the similarity goes no further than outward form. Whereas the United States is founded on the concept of limited government, the United Nations concept is one of unlimited government power, with virtually no meaningful restraints to protect individual liberty. Instead of ensuring that all member states have limited forms of government, the United Nations assumes that most of them have unlimited power over their subjects. The United Nations is not the least bit concerned over the fact that a majority of its members have governments which rule with police state methods. Instead of assuming that any power not specifically mentioned in the Constitution is reserved to the individual citizens or their smaller governmental units, the United Nations operates under the doctrine that its charter is sufficiently vague and broad so as to authorize doing absolutely anything. By the way, just a little side comment. Those that may harbor the thought that a better constitution can be written for the United States and that we ought to support that idea or we can change ours to make it work or whatever, look at the most recent example we have of when the United States had an opportunity to write a new constitution for another nation. You remember back, I think it was Jay Leno that said when we were going to have a new constitution written for Iraq, he said, why don't we just send them ours? We're not following it anymore. And if it wasn't so tragic, it'd be really funny. But the fact of the matter is, we helped them write a constitution. That constitution, and I've read a number of different versions of it because it's in Arabic and you've got to have translations, and so there's differences in translation, but so get several different copies if you're going to read it. That constitution is a Soviet-style constitution. There is no Second Amendment in it. You have the freedom of speech as controlled by law. I mean, and there's all sorts of various little Lord giveth, Lord taketh away kind of things. We helped him write it. And that's what they ended up with, was a Soviet-style constitution. What does that tell you about the intent and purpose of those that might be involved in writing a new one? It's terrifying. Okay, we're just about done with the United Nations operates under the doctrine that its charter is sufficiently vague and broad so as to authorize doing absolutely anything. And then in his book, An Enemy Had Done This, you've got to have this and read it again. It reads like today's news today. He has chapter 14. In that book is about the United Nations. The title of that chapter is The United Nations Planned Tyranny. That's a pretty succinct statement. Here we have President Gordon B. Hinckley saying, greater the promises concerning this land of America, We are told unequivocally that it is a choice land, and whatsoever nation shall possess it shall be free from bondage and from captivity and from all other nations under heaven, if they will but serve the God of the land, who is Jesus Christ. This is the great crux of the entire matter, obedience to the commandments of God. The constitution under which we live, and which has not only blessed us but has become a model for other constitutions, is our God-inspired national safeguard, ensuring freedom and liberty, justice and equality before the law. So, what is our charge? This is the wrap-up regarding war and government. We must awaken and arouse ourselves to a sense of our awful situation. We must embrace God's rules of war and government. We must become dedicated to the restoration of the proper God-inspired principles upon which this nation was founded. We must seek to expose the malevolent conspiracies which are so cleverly disguised and so powerfully promoted in our day, again, President Benson's words. And we must expose and defeat those who seek to subvert, destroy, and overthrow the proper constitutional principle which the American founders, wise men, established under the hand of God. That's it. We got done with 5 minutes to go. Okay, now, Brian, we do have to kind of wrap up and get out of here very soon, right? Okay. Is there a question in the remaining 5 minutes? Yes, ma'am.
What do you think of Mark Warren's book, The Liberty Amendment?
I think I stated a little bit earlier that anything whatsoever is more or less than this cometh of evil. The Lord's words, not mine. The Lord gave us the Constitution. The last one we helped write was the Soviet-style Constitution. My position is, what do we need? An amendment that says we really mean it this time? I mean, really, really, we have it all. We have just stopped applying it. The problem's not with the Constitution. Absolutely, whether it's our debt problems, our problems with run-amok government in healthcare or whatever, the government has abandoned the baseline principles, the limits and bounds. And we talked a little bit more about this last time, and I've got an hour and a half long presentation. You would find that hard to believe, but on the efforts to destroy the Constitution. So Mark Levin, whether he is ill-informed, I guess that would make him ignorant, or if he's part of the problem, is unknown to me. But I do not support the efforts that he has so eloquently sought to bring forth, as well as a lot of other organizations. Ken Ivory in our state, Wayne Niederhauser in our state, they're in state legislature. We have a central organization for the whole nation that's found in Utah that's seeking to rewrite the Constitution, and I reject it. I really believe that the Lord's words mean what they mean and said what they said, and I can't possibly support that. Yes, sir, right here. That's another presentation we're going to go do another time. But the fact of the matter is, the constitutional republic that was established by Mosiah was ratified by the people. The constitutional republic that was established by our founding fathers was ratified also. And it talks in the Book of Mormon about had been given by their fathers. This was given by our fathers. Our real father gave both of them, okay? And what they were doing, in fact, the 51st chapter of Alma, the people went before Pehoran, the king men did, and they sought to change fundamental things within the law. So they petitioned the government for changes. And Pehoran said, no, we're not going to abandon the original foundation that was given to us. And Pehoran was he fell out of favor. So there's a lot of interesting parallels between what happened then and what happened now. And we are fundamentally changing this nation. Hasn't there been a president that said something about that? And that change thingy that he talked about back in 2008, how's that working out for you guys? The fact of the matter is, we have so many parallels with what they've done. They're changing it by guess and by golly when the president legislates. We're changing it by legislative inaction. activity. We're changing it by court action. And the way we change it is not ever being followed. We just abandon it. And constitutions have supremacy over all other enactments. Just a second. I'll get right to you here in just a second. Let's get Lowell, and then I'll go back here to Jason.
I appreciate you bringing out J. Reuben Clark's discussion about those who are called to serve in war. Has he or the church taken a position on those who
It's my understanding that J. Reuben Clark helped many men in World War I avoid the draft. I don't know what that means. But the fact of the matter is that he talked about a constitutional authority, and we haven't had a constitutional authority. We haven't had a constitutional war since World War II. And so there's probably something that we need to think about that in depth, but I don't have enough detail about how his Underground Railroad worked. Let's go to Jason and then... On our soil? Yeah. Well, there's China and there's Spetsnaz from Russia and all those kinds of things that we're bringing over here. How many know what the governor of Idaho said about the beachhead he was going to help the Chinese establish? Did you hear about this beachhead? What's a beachhead? It's not where you go lay on the beach, lay in the sun. It's a point of invasion. It is a point from which to launch a takeover. And the governor of Idaho literally said he was going to assist the Chinese establish a beachhead just outside of Boise. I mean, he could have said a free trade zone or something like that, you know, but he said a beachhead. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. We don't inspect anything that comes into that beachhead, and they are a law unto themselves up in Idaho right now. And there's been plenty of examples to do this with the Long Beach Harbor and all those kind of things. It's just appalling to me. Do you have a question, sir?
So the World War II was a constitutional war, and J. Reuben Clark hence helped people draft.
No, this was World War I.
Oh, World War I.
Yeah, he helped. By the way, if we had time, I'd talk to you about World War I. And how it was the most asinine war that ever happened in all of history. And I'm making a judgment there on it, but it's pretty close. It's in the top 10, probably.
So are we as Americans then, because the tone is isolationist, are we as Americans to not prepare for and be part of the final battle of Armageddon, which is the Battle of Armageddon, because the Constitution might not allow us to go?
Here's the deal. We have never as a nation, ever, not even once, been isolationist. Before the War of 1812, the British had seized over 1,000 American ships. Does that sound like we were hiding in our caves waiting for something to happen? No, we were all over the world. The British were seizing our ships. We had great patience involved in that. And the War of 1812 is the one that J. Reuben Clark infers was the last just war. Okay, so the last just war that we've gone into, the point he died. So the point of the matter is that if we are to go to war, it must be done in the manner the Lord has directed, okay? If it is just, if it is defensive, if it is deliberative, if the standard of liberty has been raised, go read that 98 section. No. The Constitution was written in conformance to the 98 section of the Doctrine and Covenants.
What are the chances that this nation...
I don't know. Yeah.
Are we not our brother's keepers?
Well, we're not supposed to go to war unless the Lord directs it.
Are we not our brother's keepers?
We are as the Lord directs. Now, let me just give you an example. 1 Samuel chapter 15, Malachiahites. Lord said, don't kill, but he gave the command to Samuel to kill every man, woman, and child, even suckling child. Even the sheep and the ox and the cows and everything else had to be killed. He commands those kind of things sometimes. But it's on his directive and not our roll of the dice or our own choice.
Are we to say then that if our neighbor, our literal neighbor next door, is attacked by a bunch of thugs and we have the ability to do something about it?
No. That's an asinine discussion right now.
Are we not our brother's
keeper? We are our brother's keeper in that sense. Sir, how many times have we been lied to? How many times have we been taken into war based upon lie? The defensive position has never been followed. Okay, but so we follow the constitutional approach. We do not just willy-nilly, lock and load, and go to Iraq when there's no weapons of mass destruction, there's no threat? Why don't we do Cuba? Okay? So it's a constitutional approach where the deliberative due diligence is done, and then we can do it. There are rare opportunities to do that, but we would if there are rare opportunities. And that is exactly what J. Reuben Clark said. There will be others in other countries that are members of the church that will even be killing when that happens back here. Yeah, it does. Does. Or when we have been lied into a case where there was never, ever, ever, ever any weapons of mass destruction. They couldn't get a Cessna 150 off the ground without us shooting it down. They had nothing to do with the 9/11 stuff. Al-Qaeda was only there like they were here in opposition to the government. Everything we were told about Iraq was a lie. Let's go here, Lowell, and then we'll go in the back, and I know we got to quit.
Brian.
Not probably in the time we got left, but he was liberating American captives is what he was doing. And so, I mean, here we had an instance of where they had captured Americans and taken them, and they were, you know, capturing American ships. And it was kind of a precursor to the War of 1812 in that we had had 1,000 of our ships captured by the British. And so they were ultimately and finally the last straw happened, and we ended up doing what we needed to do. Back in the corner. Over here, and then we're done.
I was going to ask, how does the president get his power for executive orders?
He doesn't.
Overriding.
Okay. Everybody will say, they had a question about executive orders. The question of executive orders, people say, oh, George Washington had executive orders. Yes, he did. He would say to Thomas Jefferson, who was his Secretary of State, Thomas, or however he addressed him, Mr. Jefferson, I would like a report of all the trade we did with England in the past year. And Thomas Jefferson, as part of his cabinet, would rush around and he would write reports, and the Constitution directs us to do that, directs that to happen. But what the president oversteps his bound is when he starts creating law that's enacted and carried out upon the people as though it were law, whether it's an IRS ruling by an administrative law case or else he actually creates a law by fiat. Right now they publish them in the Federal Journal. The Federal Journal basically, you leave it in there for a certain period of time, and then if nobody's in Congress has opposed it, it becomes all as though it were passed by Congress. And that's a complete violation. George Washington did do executive orders, but they were within his own cabinet for things that were not creating things that basically had to be obeyed by the people. Jefferson could write his report, but it didn't mean that you had to do something about it. Okay? Okay, well. Right. And that's constitutional. We could read about that if you'd like in the Constitution, but I think we're really kind of out of... Okay, thanks.